are back with episode 709 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and no, I will never quite look at a surveillance camera the same way ever again.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and yes, I missed watching the three worst episodes this week. Hooray!
And I'm just here to tell you that if you're walking down the street and a payphone still, number one, exists, and two, starts ringing, pick it up, because you, yes, you, could be working with Sarah Shahi.
Yes, and listening to Amy Acker.
That's right. Tell me you wouldn't want to do that. Everyone out there. Anyway, we are going to be getting into a little bit of news still, and then we are going to get into the episodic discussion. So, Edmund, you got to give a little bit of a different disclaimer, I guess.
Yes, we will. We'll try and spoil you with the episodes and with our news. We're just going to make you a little sad if you haven't heard already.
That's right. So why don't we go ahead and just jump into it? And Gary, if you don't mind doing the honors.
Oh, sure. A very sad news coming out of the Star Trek camp, all the kidding about the fan issues aside. Star Trek's Anton Yelchin has passed away due to a tragic fluke of an accident. The official statement reads as, you know, a fatal traffic collision, but basically his, you know, the brakes on his car gave way and crushed him. It's really, you know, sad. He was only 27 years old. Besides his amazing popularity as a result of the Star Trek series of movies that he was in, as well as the new one just coming out, you know, he did also have a career in the films Alpha Dog, as well as the comedy Charlie Bartlett. He actually did not have to fake the Russian accent too much. He was actually born in Russia. His parents were professional figure skaters who moved here when he was a baby. So you actually had a Russian playing Chekhov, which was, a bit of an irony for the character. Again, it's very sad. You know, obviously things were very much going his way, being a popular movie franchise, and it's just a sad fluke accident. And it's never good. He's of course received, you know, accolades from directors and actors that he's worked with, it's just sad. He had, you know, seemed like he had quite a career ahead of him, as well as quite a career going on at this time. So it's a loss. You know, we expect to see all the original Star Trek people passing on, as unfortunately happens, but to have one so young cut in the prime of his life is sad.
Yeah, it really occurred to me that we lost the new Chekhov before we lost the original Chekhov, mm-hmm. which is really...
They had Walter Koenig actually eulogize him to some extent, and it was very disconcerting.
Just a little, but like you said, someone cut down so young in their life.
Yeah, and certainly from all the reports that were coming out, I mean, behind the scenes as well, of a sterling character. I mean, it's terrible when anybody has to lose their life this way, but certainly with someone with that much promise and that much respect within the industry, it just makes it particularly sad.
Mm. So yeah, unfortunately, we're starting off with a little bit of sad news. I'm sure that quite a lot of people have already heard about it, but we did not want to let it go undiscussed here on our show because, of course, whatever your opinions may be of the new Star Trek material, this was a loss, and certainly the character, I hope, will get a little bit more screen time in this last version. Unfortunately, of course, you can't do much about it now, but didn't have a whole lot to do early on, but now hopefully we'll get a little, you know, we'll be able to see something in this, his final installment anyway, in short order.
Yeah. And I actually just to expand on that point slightly. I mean, as you say, there may be controversy among in the fandom between about what they have done with the timelines and fiddling around, but I think it's been pretty universal across both camps that the actual performances and the casting that they made on redoing these original series characters, you know, was pretty darn stellar across the board.
Yeah, it's more the writing that gets maybe a little bit of criticism, and maybe the direction in certain aspects versus, say, the portrayals. I think that those have been pretty well praised, as you said. Well, that's it then. We're going to go move on from our in memoriam section and then get into our episodic discussion. And we're going to be starting off here with our bottom three, as is typically our want. This particular week is pretty amazing, actually. We've got all shows are above the average mark, but we have actually some that are well above a 9 even. So when we talk about these bottom three, we're talking about shows that just happen to be at the bottom of the list. Not necessarily bad, but just compared to shows that were stellar this week. So even among our top three, you're going to see a big, big range. So, yeah, it's worth noting. First one on our list then for the bottom three is The Musketeers, Season 3, Episode 4, The Queen's Diamonds. A visit from Louis's sister, the Queen of England, is marred by the theft of her crown jewels, which were to be used to finance the impending civil war. Meanwhile, Aramis tries to save a childhood friend from being blackmailed. And surprisingly, the two threads intersect.
Yes, of course.
Of course. This coming in at an average of 7.5. For me, it was the first time this season that I felt like it was a bit of a filler episode, even with some of the implications. But the scene with the horse.
Oh, yeah, was classic. Even though there was something in me that, you know, that kind of knew what was going on the whole time, but I think that was deliberate as well. I mean, just the audience were in on it as much as D'Artagnan was, that the way he was holding back, that he was just doing that, because it's like, you city idiots, you know, I'll just let you play with this for a while, and then I'll step in and do what any farm boy can do.
They had D'Artagnan turn to the camera and wink to the audience.
Yes.
So. But it was still classic.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do agree that sort of for the rest of it, and there was even something where, you know, I was always surprised at how they for a show, for a British show that's been sort of tweaking making the King of France to be a bit of a ninny, they were almost putting the Queen of England into the same category. Yeah, the other thing that surprised me as well. I mean, I was expecting to enjoy this a little bit more. I mean, with the return of James Callis's character, also Aramis's childhood friend, was actually being played by Laura Haddock, who had a major role on Da Vinci's Demons. But even those sort of genre or related guest starring roles, weren't really enough to elevate the story above a 7.5.
Exactly. All right, next on the list is Preacher, Season 1, Episode 4, Monster Swamp. Jesse makes Kincannon a bet he can't refuse, and Cassidy works to fend off the angels. Meanwhile, Tulip tries to bring justice to Anvil. And this one also came in at an average of 7.5. And honestly, right now, I think the problem for me with this series is that it feels like they cobble together some really interesting scenes,
mm-hmm.
but how they all are supposed to fit together into a narrative still just eludes me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of fun to watch, but especially now four episodes in. I mean, I was kind of, I was giving him a bit of a pass on the pilot of, you want to, just literally drop us into the story, like some of the characters are parachuting into the story. At this point, I think they do need to try and give us a little more of an idea rather than, it seems like, so we have the stuff with the angels and then the phone ringing and sort of, it's, you're just piling on more mysteries, rather than giving us more of a narrative handle to grab onto.
Exactly. So, it's interesting and fun in certain ways, but at the same time, it's not giving me the story hook that I really need soon for this to be an ongoing endeavor.
Yeah.
Or at least certainly it went from being potentially towards the top of my list towards, the bottom, as we see right here.
Yes.
And then we have the show that came in at the bottom at an average of 7.25, so not quite average. As I said, everything was above average, but this was the closest to average, and that is Clever Man, Season 1, Episode 3, A Free Ranger. The containment center is the site of problems that lead to more panic, while Waru and Cohen reject Slade's offer to participate in a mysterious laboratory. And if they were saying Slade here and meant Slade Wilson, I might say that this was a more interesting show,
yes.
Especially since Manu Bennett is from New Zealand, so
yes.
It would go with the whole Australian TV show thing.
Absolutely.
But, yes, this came in at an average of 7.25,
yeah.
And I liked it a little bit more than you did, even though I feel like, again, this show is not unlike Preacher, just not quite coming together.
Yeah, what's more distressing for me, I mean, the reason why I downgraded it lower was, I went and confirmed this, but the fact that this is supposed to be a 6-episode series, this is the 3rd episode, and they are spooling everything out just so slowly.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine that they're, at this point, it's more the problem of, you're either going to have to really, really rush, or you're spooling out 6 episodes, thinking we're all going to be fascinated, and we're just going to wind up going like, oh, you only got to there?
Exactly. This feels very introductory in general. So I don't know if they are... maybe the commentary in this show is so topical to the region in which it's made that we're just not picking up on layers. But I have a feeling we're international enough that we would be able to recognize... Mm-hmm. the story if we saw it.
Yeah, because certainly, you know, I mean, this isn't a case of Sundance picking something up that was, you know, local. I mean, this was a co-production between the Australians and Sundance, you know, so yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was considered something that was going to be internationally marketed. Well, I mean, the fact that they're broadcasting it virtually simultaneously here and in Australia, so.
Yeah, I guess that's true, too, is that they are expecting that this is going to be something that is topical enough that we would pick up on it. So, It may come together. We'll see. But this first season feels like it is an extended pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Is what it really feels like.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, that's our bottom three, and that means that we can turn to the top three. And what I can say is that the top three span a point and a half between these three episodes. And that means something special when we say that the number three show for the week came in at an 8.5, and it's Orphan Black, Season 4, Episode 10, From Dancing Mice to Psychopaths. Ah, sounds like a fun night. Alliances are shattered between Sarah and Rachel as Cosima is cut off from communication and the Neolution moves in. Later, Sarah sets a trap for a high-ranking Neolutionist in hopes of bringing it down for good. The fourth season finale. Yes, and as I said, an average of 8.5. And wow, this had some really interesting stuff going on. Rachel just going completely insane. Death seemed very appropriate considering just what her project was.
Absolutely, yes.
And yeah, knowing that this only has one more season, this really felt like the right note for this season to end on. It really leaves me feeling like, okay, one more go. This feels right.
Yeah, I mean, this, I mean, certainly the, no, I liked the way, certainly, you know, they continued to keep the focus on the Clone Club. We did have that one lonely caster cast off still around.
Cast off, very nice.
Yes, but and certainly the payoff of Rachel, of course, you know, just being in it for herself as always. I mean, just felt extremely true to the characters, and also, you know. No, I thought, you know, I thought, you know, rather nicely set us up for this final season, you know, with the characters, you know, all the various shades of Tatiana that we've gotten to know so well, and really setting all of them in conflict with each other. And of course the Cosima and Delphine playing out, this felt like really resetting things this season and setting it up quite nicely for the final.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. That brings us to our number two show for the week. And for a lot of people, they're going to be wondering, if this is the number two show, what could possibly be number one? If you've been paying attention, you already know the answer. But we'll leave it in suspense for those of you who are maybe new. 708. Anyway. Game of Thrones, Season 6, Episode 9, The Battle of Bastards. Jon Snow and Ramsay Bolton come face to face in the battle for Winterfell.
Yeah.
But that's not all, of course. We know that more happened, right? Yeah, this is a big one. Coming in at an average of 9.5. And, wow, where do we even begin? Well, first of all, there were basically three chunks of this episode, and I guess we're going to go through. Yeah. Before it all went through.
Big, meaty chunks, yes.
That's right. All right. I'm gonna kind of break this up into its three components as I saw them, and I wrote them up in my review. And the first one, I guess, is going to be all the stuff that happened before the actual battle. And I know that for some, this was probably the weakest part of the whole episode, but I liked the fact that they gave us a lesson in medieval battle tactics, and also helpfully outlined every single thing that Jon Snow and his army should not do right before they did all of it.
Yes.
Hey, don't do that.
See, it's not so much that in this case that Jon Snow knows nothing, because he knew all of this. He just did it anyway.
Well, Sansa knew it all.
Yeah, Sansa was sitting there just going, that's a bad idea. That's a bad idea. You know what he's going to do. That's a bad idea. And yeah.
Fine,
really
fine, do it.
Yeah, exactly. What were your thoughts on the preamble to the battle, Gary?
As I was sort of intimating, I sort of enjoyed Stanza saying, you know, basically giving the warnings that Jon should have already sort of known. He was sort of heated up into the battle, but it seemed almost uncharacteristically John. He's always seemed to be just a touch more thoughtful. He might be swayed from time to time, but usually he gives a little bit more planning into something. So that it did sort of surprise me that he was so emotional about Rickon that I realized that everyone grew up together in Winterfell. But at the same time, it seemed more like that. You know, they obviously shared moments that we're not aware of. So that was something that stood out to me before we actually get towards the battle.
Yeah, you mentioned Rickon, and that was one of the things that really came to my mind was that, maybe because he's young, he didn't think about this for a second, but, oh, duck and weave, man. Zigzag.
Well, you know, I thought about that, but that wouldn't have worked because when Ramsay was finally ready to just kill him, he aimed straight at him and just shot him. So, as much as you'd like to say, oh, weave, that's because he was just toying with him. That was all. As soon as he was ready to kill him, boom, it went right through him.
I recognize. It's just, I mean, it is the obvious thing to say is like, did you have to run in a straight line just to make it easy for him? But at the same time, we're talking about Ramsay, who had been shown many times to have some pretty high weapons proficiency.
Yeah.
And also was very clearly waiting for the right moment to strike him right through the heart.
Yeah.
So, Edmund, your thoughts on the preamble to the battle?
I guess that is where it lost my half point down to 9.5. It was also after all of this time, all these years we've been watching, all this stuff that they've gone through themselves. For John to, you know, to take the bait with Rickon like that, just really, you know, I was like, guys, you know, I mean, and I think part of the problem is, I mean, the way they have built up Ramsay, you know, over all of this time, where they kind of want to, you know, they want to make him appear to be this sort of master manipulator, but they made him so over the top with it, that it just doesn't have that subtlety, and it just, you know, just smacks of, you know, yes, you know, he's doing an obvious thing here to, you know, try and poke the bear, you would think the bear or the wolf or whatever would wise up eventually.
Yeah, one thing that I do feel like I need to point out too, and it's towards myself as much as anybody else, is that I learned even today, right before we were about to record, I was actually with my family, and they are Game of Thrones enthusiasts to a degree. And what I found was is that some of the things about this battle situation that were really obvious to us were completely not obvious to your normal everyday viewer.
Okay,
for me, it was. I found it to be, you know, they gave their little lesson during the pre-battle stuff of all these tactics and stuff that Ramsay was going to employ, and I'm sure that it sounded like old hat to a lot of us. It wasn't to everybody. So I guess some of the things that maybe felt a little bit like like beating you over the head with a certain number of things and being a little obvious, maybe it wasn't. And I just wanted to kind of point out that, yeah, it is hard if you are into this kind of material at all, or even into military history, to recognize that some of these concepts are actually pretty brand new to people without any type of background in it. I was kind of fascinated to watch some people who are not immersed in this kind of material today as they were talking about the episode, especially some of these parts. It was like, oh, really? Wow, what's a pincer move? It's like, really? Okay. I kind of thought that was something people knew about, but I mean, that's probably a presumption, or apparently one. But that's just my own observation. I think we can all agree, though, the actual Battle of Bastards,
mm-hmm.
from a technical point of view, on television.
Yeah.
This was television.
Yes.
I mentioned it somewhere, maybe not in my review, but I was brought to mind to some of the larger sequences from Braveheart, and mm-hmm. this, I think, actually exceeded it.
Mm-hmm.
And on, you know, granted, I know that the budget was huge for this battle. It was something around $25 million and it took about a month to film. And yeah, it was easily one of the most grueling things that they've ever done in the production to date. I mean, there's a lot of information out there about this. I would encourage any fan to go ahead and look some of that up, because it's fascinating what they had to do with some of this stuff. And it was really tough on the actors, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to mention that myself. I mean, I've made clear previously, you know, I tend to avoid previews. I often, do not look at behind the scenes stuff that much. But in this case, I think there was something else. You know, it was good old YouTube autoplay. I think there was something else HBO related that I went to see. And the next scene was one of those 10-minute featurettes on the filming of this battle, and it was quite extraordinary to see them putting it together. And you know, so just particular things in terms of the horse work and. But also, I mean, the thing that, you know, that does always amaze me on this sort of stuff as well was the way they were able to do a lot of this stuff, and with appropriate pads and fall areas, and where no horses and stunt people were not getting injured doing this. I mean, you know, that always always amazes me how they managed to rig things to pull that off and still make it look like it's just bone crunching terror out there.
Mm-hmm. Bone crushing terror, that would be a really good way to put it. Let's see. Gary, what were your thoughts on this one?
I mean, they'd always made a point early on and for several episodes that they were going to be undermanned against Bolton's forces, but it surprised me not only to the extent that they were undermanned, but that they were outskilled. That, you know, as he was making as they were forming these different battle formations, the Wildings and were just clueless on what to do and how to prevent or stop it from happening or combat against it. They were just literally getting poked to death. It was almost disheartening that there wasn't some, you know, brief run of force through to that there wasn't a way to break that line, even if it still wasn't an overwhelming victory, but that they were stuck in there like penned cattle was a bit surprising that it happened and happened as easily as it did.
Well, one of the things that I think they of course played this up as much as they could, but one of the things that was a little bit to the detriment, and I didn't really take anything off for this, but they made just about every mistake they could make. There was really, if it wasn't for the Army of the Veil coming in at the right moment, they were done.
Oh yeah,
there was absolutely nothing to be done. Now I did see in one of the featurettes, which was really interesting, that the late arrival of the cavalry here was inspired a bit by the Battle of Waterloo, of all things, where historically this kind of last minute. The arrival of a saving grace of a force actually had happened and was in fact the reason why Napoleon lost.
Huh.
So it's historically based, I suppose one could say, which is fascinating to think. But I think it was. It definitely plays on the emotions of the audience a little bit. And just because it is, in fact, something that could have happened historically, doesn't mean that it is that it isn't manipulative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, for me, I mean, it was sort of that was the other thing that slightly downgraded the episode for me, but not because I was going, oh, you were just using the Waterloo tactic. It was more that, you know, okay, just like Stannis rushing in with his forces, you know, it felt like they were recycling stuff from within the show.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit, yeah, it does feel that way. Now, of course, now that they have Winterfell back, I think that we all feel really happy that the true tenants of Winterfell are back in action. But in fact, there is, of course, the next step, which is going to be dealing with, the immediate problem of River Run and the Freys.
Yes.
To the south. So it's not as though this is the end of the story by any means. But there is somebody who wants Walder Frey dead that didn't show up in time for the battle. Just thinking out loud. Someone with skills and pretending to be someone that they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Just thinking to myself, that's something interesting.
Just keep that on your list, John.
Keep it on the list. That's right. But that's, look, The Battle of Bastards, if you have any interest in this show whatsoever, you know that it was one of the most amazing sequences that the show has ever had. It is a technical feat, if not the one of the most impressive things in quite some time for the show. So by all means, you've probably already seen it. And if you haven't, this is worth seeing. Even out of context, this is pretty much worth seeing. But it's not the only awesome thing that happened in this episode. As we had kind of predicted early on, the battles for Marine and for Winterfell would happen at roughly the same time. I just don't think that we expected Marine to be so easy. Wow, what did you think of that, Gary?
It surprised me that they were willing to level the whole town in the attack, or at least the attackers were trying to. I had always had the sense that they wanted to basically take Marine and restore it to its pre-freed status. So, but they looked like they were coming in and they were, you know, even shaking the temple. So they were trying to basically destroy the whole city, which was struck me as odd for people who wanted to return to the status quo. What else? The dragons, while they are strong, almost seem too strong. Seems like they're such an easy wild card to solve problems that, it's pretty to see the effects, at the same time, they fix things too quickly, at least for me. A little too clean and a little too fast.
Mm-hmm. Maybe so, and that it did feel a little bit quick, but at the same time, what I liked was that they didn't have them so overpowering that they just completely wiped out the fleet of the slave masters in one fell swoop. They went after one boat, made their presence known, and it was more of the morale-crushing that took place that I think was the important turning point. That, and I loved personally the fact that Daenerys was going to just wipe them clean, and then Tyrion actually got his mojo back a little bit and was able to be a true advisor again. And in this episode, he actually played the hand of the queen rather well.
Absolutely.
Edmund, your thoughts on Marie?
I think you've pretty much covered it. But especially after these last couple of episodes of Tyrion twiddling his thumbs and trying to find witty conversation. It was definitely nice to see him back on the stump and throwing his weight around again.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we also have now the alliance between, as we expected to happen, between House Targaryen and the Iron Isles, so House Greyjoy, the unofficial House Greyjoy.
Yes.
But I have a feeling it's going to turn into the official one relatively fast, especially when Yara happened to mention that, the king of our little house here expects to come and bed you. Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Okay. Yes. Her reaction was just like, this is going to be fun. I'm going to teach this one something. But to me, this is interesting for a few different reasons. I've mentioned this before. I think that Varys went to Dorne. I think it's pretty obvious that's what happened. And it wouldn't surprise me then if what we're going to find is that there is this really strong female-fronted power block that Daenerys is creating.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to have the Sand Snakes that... Think about this for a second. Dorne, regardless of whatever is happening, House Martell has effectively fallen, and none of the Sand Snakes can be the ruler, legitimately. They're bastards.
Right.
So that leaves a huge door open for them to simply say, okay, we're going to fall in line with you, Daenerys. I think the Sand Snakes would love having Daenerys as queen. The Iron Isles now. We see the Yara and Theon basically being willing to fall in line and to completely change their culture to fall in line. Which is a big move, basically, so that Yara can be queen of her little house there. We then have who knows what's going to happen with some of the other ones, but I think it's fairly clear who runs House Smart Tyrell in Highgarden. I wonder if they would turn to the Targaryens if things went south with the Lannisters for some reason. So I'm seeing all these female leaders of houses falling behind Daenerys. Interesting that.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I, 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 even though this has been building for a while, yeah, I hadn't quite seen that aspect of it, and I like that a lot. I mean, just when you were initially talking about it, I mean, you know, I was thinking Iron Isles and Dorne and you know, pincer movement just popped into my head again. But yeah, I mean, as a, you know, as an underlying sort of a social aspect of all this, I think that's a wonderful point.
Especially considering the fact that the show has been so criticized for the way that female characters are treated, it would be awfully ironic if a lot of the final state of play had women in positions of power.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, not to mention this battle we just watched that was won by Sansa.
Sansa and her friend
are already in power.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Essentially, they are. The reasons that they got there, perhaps not the ones that we would want. But I think even if you were to look at this from the point of view of Jon and Sansa, like you said, Edmund, who is really the leader of House Stark right now?
Yeah.
And I say Stark in quotes, by the way, at least up until the end of the episode. Because guess what? with the Bolton, basically, Sansa has to be the one because she is the unifying figure as the wife of Ramsay Bolton.
Mm-hmm.
She's technically the legitimate ruler of the house. Bolton.
Yep.
And Stark. So everything that Ramsay and House Bolton wanted to get out of having Sansa as Ramsay's wife, they did, just it's all in Sansa's hands now. And Jon really is more the military commander for House Stark.
For better or worse, yes.
Of course, there could be other reasons why he needs to be a little off to the side.
Yes,
I know. Just saying. All right, but no, I just wanted to make that point because I personally love it. I mean, the end of this episode with Sansa and that look on her face as she reunited Ramsay with his pets.
Yes.
That grin.
Glorious.
Love. Love.
I was going to say character development. Gosh, she's come a long way since that little cowering girl that you know, hopped over the wall at Winterfell.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. she is a force to be reckoned with, and I think Peter better look over his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
Because she got what she needed. She doesn't need him now, nope. I don't think. But yeah, I love the fact that the female characters are getting so much power at this point in stage of the game. And I have a feeling we're not done with the power moves from some of the women in the show.
Yeah.
I think with one episode left, I think we have one character in particular who has an ace up her sleeve to resolve a certain problem with overreaching religious organizations.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yep. I think this season's going to go out with a bang. Let's just put it that way. All right. That
Which
is...
woman?
Yeah, that actually is not a bad question.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to move on then to... That was our number two.
Yes.
For the week.
How can that be, John? It was so amazing and incredible. And
I do want...
$25 million.
Okay, hold on. I do want to give this one comment from our friend Flacco Jones over at VogueNetwork.com. He did leave a comment about Game of Thrones. He said, amazing battle sequence on par with anything I've seen in a major motion picture, but the predictability of the episode was a bit too much to bear, along with some of the dumb character decisions that you mentioned in the review. Still, overall, it was fantastic and one of the best episodes of the season on its technical merits alone. So it kind of covers some of our criticisms as well.
Yes.
That said, coming in at a 9.5, it was only the number two episode. So, gee, what could that top one be? Wait, the phone's ringing. Yes, Person of Interest, yes. Season 5, episode 13.
Oh, I wish I'd had a payphone ringtone to queue up just now. But anyway.
Return Zero. In the series finale, Finch, Reese, Fusco, and Shaw tried to keep Samaritan from destroying the machine and strengthening its grip on humankind. This episode, the series finale of Person of Interest, coming in at a perfect 10.
Yeah.
Did anyone really doubt that? That's anyway. We had our worries.
And they did earn it legitimately.
They most certainly did. Yes. I'll say this much: the thing for me that really I took away from this, beyond the fact that it was really just a perfectly rendered ending that was a little bit open ended.
Yes,
you never know what we might find down the road.
Yeah, that was a very pleasant surprise that we'll get into.
Yes.
Given all you know. Well, the producers also did really earn their stripes as. World class manipulators of the audience in terms of what they did let sneak out before the finale aired.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. One of the things I guess that it occurred to me as I was watching this episode, and of course there's going to be spoilers, just deal with it, people. As it was setting up John's demise, was it, I recalled all the way back 5 years ago that the opening of the episode of the pilot was with John.
Yes.
And it occurred to me, the reason why John is the character that has to go in this finale is because this series actually is his story. And as much as it became about Finch and about the machine and about the war of AIs and all of this other stuff, it began and ended with him finding his purpose in life. And it just happened to be dying for the human race in this very strange cyberpunk-esque situation. And it was done exactly the way it had to go. I was astounded at the fact that Reese went down with actually almost a smile on his face. His life fulfilled.
And, you know, although it did amuse me a little bit, I mean, even though, you know, it was obvious to me that, you know, Reese is gone, that, you know, that's what, as you said, I mean, I didn't quite put it together with the opening and closing, you know, but certainly for Reese's story, you know, this was the satisfactory ending. You know, because some people had said, it's like, oh no, well, he was still moving when he, you know, as he was being shot, you know, and we didn't see the cruise missile hit, and it was like, oh, you know, come on, folks, it's, even the producers after the fact have basically been, you know, saying, it's like, you know, no, John, you know, John Reese is gone, he, this was his sacrifice to make sure everything happened. But what I loved was the whole construction of the episode. You know, where they were setting up, you know, the couple of red herrings where you see Finch initially with the gunshot wound, and then starting to play, you know, the story, you know, the storytelling and timeline games, you know, that they've done so well. I mean, this is a series, you know, that regularly, you know, was taking you back in time, you know, with the machine's feed, you know, scrolling back, you know, so you got used to it. But the way they were jumping back and forth with the different elements just within that day, and you know, just, you know, and showing you the little hints and tidbits, you know, and then slowly bringing it all together, you know, to that moment of after you've been following him for so long, and you know, and having all, you know, and using that time to have all of these amazing character moments. Finch with his hallucination of Root as the machine, Finch and Reese down in the Federal Reserve, you know, with Harold making, you know, what he believes to be his sacrifice to save John and do what has to be done, you know, to then that final reveal. And also loving the fact that, you know, that it was this thing of, you know, of Reese saying, you know, no, me and the machine had this pact that, you know, no, you know, you were the one who had to survive. To my mind, I mean, there was part of me wondering, you know, but when did this happen, given the fact that, you know, the machine's only been open, you know, didn't get fully opened up until this season. But just the way they were able to, you know, give you all of these wonderful moments with each of the characters in the midst of, you know, still doing their, you know, kneecapping, cyber hacking, you know, action all over the city to take down the final version of Samaritan. I mean, it was just a marvelously done piece of work. I mean, you know, just satisfying on so many levels.
Very true. Very true. So yeah, that's a perfect 10. Really, no better way for this particular series to go out.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, another thing I just sort of recall, but it was just something that popped into my head early on during my initial viewing. I have watched it twice so far because I knew I had to go back. But certainly, you know, compared to, you know, what certainly among this group, and we probably consider our top series finale, Sleeping in Light from Babylon 5. I mean, you know, but that was part of, where I knew about 10 to 15 minutes in, it's like, you know, unless something goes really wrong, I know this is a 10, was because I was getting that same sort of emotional resonance I got from Sleeping in Light. You know, and yes, tears were shed, not as copiously as they tend to be during Sleeping in Light, but definitely. You know, feel, you know, the emotional resonance this brought up, and you know, and even just the little details of you know, and one thing I've also found fascinating in reading some of the reactions to it. I mean, that whole thing of Harold getting his reunion with Grace, and some people, did get annoyed about that, you know, thinking it's like, you know, Reese made the sacrifice, and you know, and Harold was the one who was always getting in the way, you know, and not freeing the machine, you know, and he's the reason why all these people die, you know, like Reese and Root died and didn't need to. You know, and it was like, you know, well, yeah, but then you weren't paying attention to what, you know, Reese's story actually was and what Reese himself, you know, tells Harold. But it meshed so beautifully with that flashback to Grace from earlier on, you know, where you're thinking, it's like, you know, wait, why is, you know, we're almost wondering, why is that scene in there? Except it's the scene that gives you the key to the fact that, yes, he's going to show up supposedly dead, and that's going to be fine. You know, that whole, you know, I can't remember the exact line, but, you know, but Grace saying, it's like, I love you no matter what, you know, that's what it means. You know, so knowing that, you know, and also there was the slightly, inside joke part of that, I thought that, you know, it was a very subtle detail, but she's painting, the Duomo in Florence, you know, so, you know, it's another Nolan Brothers production that's happened to have wound up with an unlikely pairing in the Italian countryside.
Indeed. It's, it just, as you said, you know, I've also seen it a couple times now, and it is one of those episodes that just, we've been singing the praises of this show for a long time, and it's always great to see a show stick the landing.
Yeah.
And yeah. I do believe that even if this season started a little rough, it was probably because they had to get to this ending a little faster than they were hoping to.
Yeah.
It was probably just some minor adjustments in timing. But the ending was on point.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and one thing I did, I mean, one thing I particularly liked about, you know, about them really nailing this is that it now just makes it so much easier to go out to... You know, yes, I mean, there are still those of us on the trenches, you know, hoping to get a continuation, but we can now unequivocally go out and tell people, it's, you know, yes, it's on Netflix, it's, you know, it's syndicated on WGN now, which anybody with a cable account has, basically, and thanks to WGN, I now have most of the past seasons, you know, just go and watch it. It is worth it.
Yeah, this is one that I've archived and kept for myself as well. I have the entire series, so I'm not giving it up.
No, absolutely.
By any means. All right. We have a little bit of time left, I believe. And, we're at it. Actually, you know what? We're going to go ahead and wrap this episode here. And we will come back next time with the continuation and the wrap-up of the rest of the episodes for this week and any open topics that we might have. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.